This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Okay, Mr. Producer, Charles texted me, and he says that, I'll text him back. He says he's ready. I'm not sure what's going on. We've got some little technical difficulties here, and we're trying to get our guests on. Okay. Hopefully that'll happen momentarily. Anyway, it is September 2nd, 2017, and we're coming up on Labor Day, and it's a day I'll always remember because I went into labor with my very first child on Labor Day. How's that for timing? Anyway, this is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola, and I'm broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs. Thanks for joining me today on RBN. Their website is republicbroadcasting.org. And to listen to the archives of this program, select my name in the archives section at RBN. And please also visit and subscribe to SpingolaSpeaks.net and WoolliesBlog.blogspot.com. I also invite you to visit ScreeningSandyHook.net. I've just uploaded a couple of new articles there. Anyway, during the program, email questions or comments to comment@spingola.email. Do not send questions to my regular email address, which is deanna@spingola.email, because I don't look at that email program or that email address during the program. And actually, I don't look at comment@spingola.email except on Saturday for 3 short hours. So if you want to send questions, please send them to comment@spingola.email. We also invite you to join the chat room, and you can do that by visiting spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the third hour at 800-313-9443. Just to visit our guest lineup, visit Spingola.com, click on the radio schedule button, and select the year, month, and day, because that's where I have all the links to all the programs. And you can see who is going to be visiting in the future and who has been visiting in the past. Alrighty. I have some relevant links to other things too. And I want to also alert you to the fact that there is a petition at the White House, and I have a link to that website. And the petition is there for upholding First Amendment rights. And I urge all of the listeners to please visit and sign that petition. As I said, the link is on my website. It's also in the chat room. And I do encourage you to please visit that link. Alrighty. My guest today is Charles Kraft. His website is charlescraft.com. And his last name is spelled K-R-A-F-F-T. Okay, what we might want to do, Mr. Producer, is call him on the phone if there's a problem with contacting him via Skype. Skype can be problematic at times. I know sometimes we have trouble just during the talk show. It'll kind of go off and we have to reconnect. So anyway, I don't know whether it depends on what we're talking about or whether it's just a coincidence. But anyway, that might be what you'd like to do is call him on the phone, and we'll do the program via the telephone. But anyway, you'll keep me posted. What we're going to be talking about today is is a, we're going to be talking about World War II and about, specifically about a document. It's an 18-page document, which I have linked on the schedule page, and it's called Britain's Rumor Factory. Now, I've written quite a little bit about World War II and specifically about what didn't happen. We all hear the rumors about what was supposed to have happened, and it did not happen that way. Okay, I have a message here. Let's see what's going on. Okay, all righty. It's from somebody else. Okay. Anyway. Okay. Okay, let me just end. All right. This is very exciting today. Okay. Do we have our guest? Oh, great. Great. Charles, welcome to the program. Welcome to the program. Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, I'm having some, plug-in trouble here with my, looks like it's an outdated Skype program.
Oh, well, if it's working, then great. Sometimes those updates don't really help. They've been trying to get me to update my Skype, and I said, no, I don't think so.
All I want to do is just accept the phone call from your, board operator, and it has all these, new options for me to do.
Yeah.
But I'm confused by it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, as long as you're here, and we can talk about the things that we're going to talk about, that's the important thing. And so, anyway, if you don't use Skype a lot, it is difficult to use, I think.
Well, it usually works for me. And I just, when somebody calls, I hit that little button that's got that blue and white phone thing.
Yeah.
And every time I hit that now, let's see, every time I hit it, I get a conference call plug-in that I apparently don't have, and then they want me to download that.
Huh. Maybe they know what we're going to talk about today or something.
I don't know. maybe during the break, your board guy can help me go through this, and we can get back on Skype.
He's terrific. He's really terrific. So you're not on Skype.
No, I'm on my phone now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay.
It's an emergency.
Yes. Thank goodness for telephones, right? Who would have thought?
Okay. They're easier.
They are, sure. Well, we're going to talk about something that's very interesting, something that I've written a little bit about. And you sent us a document. So let's tell us a little bit about the origin of this document. And why it's become available, and for what reason?
The origins of the document first appeared on a website that is a British nationalist website, and I think it's called Heritage and Destiny, and then. It was picked up by Kodo and brought over to Inconvenient History. I think that's where they have a copy there.
Right.
That's at the Kodo site. So listeners, if they want to follow along with our conversation, can either go to the Heritage and Destiny site and look it up, and I could probably guide them there.
Well, or they can go to the link. I have a link on the schedule page. All they have to do is click the link, and the link is in the chat room so people can follow along. And it's very interesting. We just have been deluged with all kinds of false information that actually had its birth before the war even began, and during the war, all the rumors, well, that's why you call it Britain's Rumor Factory, that all of this stuff started, and the reason it started, they wanted to really destroy the Germans' belief. They wanted to make them feel discouraged, and that they were losing. I mean, they really had a lot of programs that were designed to, they were really into propaganda. Very much well, into propaganda.
You know what happened? I mean, we can skip ahead, and after the war, the psychological warfare soldiers who were in the various psychological warfare organizations and departments went to work in academia and then in the private sector and ended up using their skills against us as a populace for social engineering experiments, because they learned during their experience in the war how to manipulate opinion. And they honed it then, and you can imagine what kind of perfection they brought it to 70 years after the war. Now it's a science, and it has to do with psychology, and they're very good at what they do.
They are, definitely.
So the thing about the essay Britain's Rumor Factory, which I thought was really important, was that it takes the Holocaust revisionism research out of concentration camp forensics, where it's been stuck since the Zundel trial in 1985, and bumps it into the intelligence realm of research. And this is the first essay I've ever run across that looks at intelligence in the Holocaust. And I say that it out of the concentration camps and into the gentlemen's clubs, because these spies and psychological warfare soldiers were from, you know, the aristocratic class in Britain and from our upper classes in America, the elites. They went into these departments. And so I've been waiting for years for somebody to start poring over the archives and you know, research how the spies were working. And this is the first kind of interesting essay that I've run across. So I was really excited about it, and I mentioned it to you because I thought we should publicize it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And
It was written in 2017, which is this year. And,
right.
The author is a fellow named Andy Ritchie, whom I've corresponded with, but he doesn't seem to be receptive to interviews, I guess, because I asked him about an interview and I didn't hear back. But what he did was he went into the British National Archive at Kew Gardens, I would assume, and.
Right.
And he found these new documents that were released after the David Irving, Deborah Lipstadt trial. And the thing about this essay is that it revolves around a piece of a document that David Irving presented to the court while he was there suing Deborah Lipstadt for libel, but the trial got out of his hands and it became a Holocaust trial rather than a libel trial, really.
It really did, and he really paid a huge price.
Yeah, he did, and he was outgunned by 26-1 because she brought 26 law clerks and researchers and lawyers with her.
Liars.
In court. Yeah, and, you know, they didn't even put her on the stand.
They didn't need to.
Well, it would have been kind of interesting, but they learned their lesson in the Zundel trial, you know, when they had Rudolf Verba on the stand and that other Verba, and then you know, the guy that wrote the three books, the two volume urtext on the Holocaust and the disappearance of the European Jews, I forget his name. He didn't want to come back and testify again.
Right, he learned his lesson.
Roald Hilberg.
Right, yes.
Yeah,
they were asking questions and he couldn't, he had to lie and he couldn't answer them.
He said, Doug Christie, he was cross-examined, and they realized that if you let these witnesses in Holocaust trials get cross-examined, you might find out that they don't know what they're talking about.
Sure.
So Hilberg had to go back and rewrite his book because he had written that there was a Hitler order, you know,
right,
to implement the Holocaust, and there wasn't one, and he had to admit that on trial. And so when he went and rewrote his book for the edition that came out after the Zundel trial, he said that the high command of the German military were communicating by telepathy. they knew what each other's thoughts were, and they had a secret kind of a code language, and so they didn't need an order. They just knew.
Gosh.
So anyway, they don't want to put Deborah Lipstadt on trial after this debacle of Raoul Hilberg in Toronto. So
sure.
Anyway, there was this document.
That is amazing, though, that so many people learned so much from those two trials. And I guess Deborah Lipstadt also learned a few things, not to be put on the witness stand.
Yeah.
She's really a piece of work.
Well, have you seen that movie that they made of the trial? Denial?
No, I don't intend to.
Well,
or maybe I should, I don't know. I don't go to movies much.
Yeah, you don't have to waste your time with it.
I haven't been to the movies for ages.
Yeah, me neither. But I went with a friend of mine that wanted to review it, so I sat through the damn thing.
It's painful, right?
Well, it's just silly. I mean, once you understand, this is another thing about the Holocaust that people don't know, is that at Nuremberg, motion picture film was entered as evidence for the first time in the history of jurisprudence. And the motion picture that they entered as evidence was a melange of creatively edited Signal Corps film footage of the liberation of the concentration camps, which looked like people were being exterminated. That was the inference,
right,
you know. And so even the defendants were shocked because of the way that this footage was edited. It was so creative and well done that
right,
they were shocked. And Nuremberg was a theater, so the looks on their faces as the lights are dimmed in the courthouse and they're presented with this film, were being filmed by the media, you know, they were capturing their faces. And that was used to sort of demonize them in the media, of course. And,
sure. And that was a military tribunal, and so they weren't allowed to actually defend themselves. They weren't allowed to have representation. It was a military tribunal by the people who had actually committed the crimes in Europe.
Yeah, no, they didn't. They weren't allowed a defense. You're right about that. I'm getting off the subject here a little bit to C.D. Jackson. C.D. Jackson was Dwight Eisenhower's intelligence major domo, and he worked with the U.S. Army Department of Psychological Warfare as an assistant to Brigadier General Robert McClure. And
right,
C.D. Jackson and William S. Paley of CBS. C.D. Jackson was the editor-in-chief of Time, Life, and Fortune magazines. He was way up in the Henry Luce,
sure,
publishing corporation.
All righty. We're going to take a 3-minute break. We'll be right back, and maybe our producer can help you with your Skype. Be right back. guest today is Charles Kraft, and that is K-R-A-F-F-T. His website is charleskraft.com. Okay, you were talking about Jackson, and that would be Robert H. Jackson. And they
Charles Robert Jackson, C.D., Charles David Jackson, I think it is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, not Robert Jackson. Robert Jackson was the head of he was a judge. D.D. Jackson, I was saying, was a psychological warfare wizard who worked for Henry Luce.
Okay.
And there were three men that were at the head of the U.S. Department of Psychological Warfare, SHAFE, which is Supreme Allied Expeditionary Force. And it was Brigadier Generals. Robert McClure, C.D. Jackson, and William S. Paley, who headed up CBS. And Jackson was from Life magazine. He was ahead of Life.
Right.
Okay, so, I don't know what my thought was before that. C.D. Jackson was at Buchenwald, and he was there with Billy Wilder, and they set up a atrocity display table that included what they told people were a human skin lampshade and a shrunken head, and those were presented at Nuremberg as evidence. And it's been proven since then that there was no human lampshade, and those, I think there were two heads, and those were from some natural history museum. They were Amazonian Ivaro, Indian, what they called Sansa, shrunken heads. That was all set up to be filmed. And, again, film was used to capture the looks of the local, townspeople down the road in Weimar, Germany, who were force marched by the U.S. Army up to the camp and then shown this stuff on this table and told through an interpreter that the camp commandant had been shrinking heads and skinning inmates. And then the photographer would photograph the looks on their faces, and some of these people broke down and put their hands over their eyes and expressed horror and shock, and that was used as part of post-war propaganda and shown to Americans in our newsreels. That's the way we got to see a lot of that stuff.
Wow. Now, wasn't there one couple that actually committed suicide? The mate and his wife of one of the towns?
I don't know. I mean, a camp inmate or what? What are you talking about?
One of the German, a couple who was force marched down to see all of this committed suicide.
After they went to visit the Buchenwald?
Yes.
They went home to their house?
Yes.
They
felt so
killed themselves?
Horrible. Yes. I don't remember what their names were.
Yeah.
They committed suicide. I'll try and find it.
Suppose that they committed suicide because they were tangentially involved in the camp, or just because they were shocked?
They were shocked, and they could not believe that Germans could do those kinds of things. And they believed what they were told. They saw what they thought was evidence. They felt so incredibly terrible that they committed suicide.
Oh, man. Well,
I'll try and find notes.
Okay. Back to the Britain's Rumor Factory, this essay.
Right.
What Andy Ritchie found at Kew Gardens in the National Archives was evidence that wasn't available during the Irving trial. Irving brought up this message that the head of the Joint Intelligence Committee of the...
All right, we're going to a quick 3-minute break, and I did find the name of the couple. Okay, we'll be right back in 3 minutes. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Charles Kraft. His website is charlescraft.com, and you spell the last name K-R-A-F-F-T. And I did find the note. And it was reported by Patton. General Patton reported this, that the mayor of Gotha, which was a small town close to where they were, where they set up in, pardon me? To Buchenwald. Yes. And that they were so upset over seeing the horrors that they saw that they had committed suicide. That's according to Patton.
Well, that's unfortunate because what they saw was all fake.
Think,
and it was a psychological.
That have believed what they saw.
Yeah, it was a psyops, and it was part of a psychological warfare operation that was orchestrated by C.D. Jackson.
Right.
Where were we now? We were going back to, there's information about the British, it's called the PWE. It's a political warfare executive, was a branch of, British intelligence that was the Black Ops Department, meaning Black Propaganda Department of the Special Operations Executive. And the man that was a liaison between the SOE, the PWE, and the Ministry of Information was Victor Cavendish Bentinck.
Right.
And Bentinck said towards the end of the war in a memo that he sent to somebody, and I don't remember what that memo was. Who that memo was sent to, but Irving had a copy of it, and he presented it at his trial, and it said that he thought that it was time to retire the Gassing's story.
Wow.
And that I remember at the time wondering why that wasn't examined more closely during the Irving trial. Well, what Andy Ritchie says in his essay is that there was no way to really look further into that note of Victor Cavendish Bentinck's, that inner office memo about retiring the Gassing story, because the archives had not been opened up at that time, and they didn't get opened. That information wasn't made available to researchers until 2015. So when Andy Ritchie apparently went to find out more about Bentinck's note to Irving, I mean note to whoever it was that he was sending his inner office memo to, I don't remember. When he went to research that, having read about it at Irving's site, because Irving mentioned it, he found out more information about these departments in British intelligence that were creating what were called SIBs, and SIBs are rumors, and SIB is from the Latin, which means let's see here, I gotta look at this. It's from a Latin word for whisper, and I think it means is sibilante or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And what had been going on was that the PWE had been starting to spread rumors about Poles being gassed in 1940. And Robert Evans, who was the guy that was the main historical witness against Irving at that trial, in his summation of what went down, said that there was no evidence, there was no further evidence to confirm that memo, you know, Bentinck's memo. But there was evidence to confirm it, and Andy Ritchie found it, and he found a lot of it. And that's what the essay is about. And it's the various kinds of SIBs, or rumors, that were started by this special department of the British Intelligence Service.
Right.
So they started the rumors the main thing that came up was this one thing that got scuttled. Let me read this to you, okay? Cavendish Bentinck wasted no time in passing this analysis on later that day to the Foreign Office top brass. Well, in my opinion, he says, it's incorrect to describe Polish information regarding German atrocities as trustworthy. The Poles, and to a far greater extent, the Jews tend to exaggerate German atrocities in order to stoke us up. They seem to have succeeded. Mr. Allen and myself have both followed German atrocities quite closely. I do not believe that there is any evidence which would be accepted in a law court that Polish children have been killed on the spot by Germans when their parents were being deported to work in Germany, or that Polish children have been sold to German settlers. As regards putting Poles to death in gas chambers, I do not believe that there is any evidence that this has been done. There have been many stories to this effect, and we have played them up in PWE rumors. So he's admitting that the political warfare executive has been playing up these rumors about gassing without believing that they had any foundation. At any rate, there is far less evidence than exists for the mass murder of Polish officers by the Russians at Katyn. On the other hand, we do know that the Germans are out to destroy the Jews of any age unless they are fit for manual labor. Well, that's debatable. I mean, I think he's just reiterating some sort of propaganda because he doesn't have any further evidence to prove that. But anyway, he goes on, I think that we weaken our case against the Germans by publicly giving credence to atrocity stories for which we have no evidence. These mass executions in gas chambers remind me of the stories of employment of human corpses during the last war for the manufacture of fat, which was a grotesque lie and led to the true stories of German atrocities being brushed aside as being mere propaganda. I'm very sad to see that we must needs ape the Russians and talk about Hitlerite instead of German. That's just one little thing. And then this was a telegram that was sent out to the Allies from British intelligence. He added a postscript. He says, on further reflection, we are not convinced that evidence regarding the use of gas chambers is substantial enough to justify inclusion in a public declaration, and would prefer it if the United States government agree that sentence in question should end at concentration camps. Please telegraph the United States government views urgently. Okay. So what he did was he and his superior, they stopped this rumor that children were being sold to German settlers and that Poles were getting gassed in camps in Poland. So,
my goodness.
Yeah.
And of course, they also start, well, you mentioned the rumors after the first war. And so
yeah,
this
there was
isn't something that was new.
No, this was something that they did in World War I, which they regretted because, as you said, there were atrocities, but these atrocities that were committed were brushed aside as propaganda because they'd spread so many lies about other atrocities that they couldn't really get anybody to believe it, the ones that did happen.
Sure. People tend to have a short memory, though, and with a 30-year break between the wars, not quite 30, but...
Well, you have to be you have to be curious about this stuff in the first place to even get this far with propaganda. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's kind of a it's an acquired taste because it's you're following footnotes in these very, very dry books of history written by people who aren't necessarily going to tell you the truth about things. But anyway, so...
And as you say, they started using film, and people became more accustomed to seeing things on film. It's much easier for people now to watch a 15-minute video and get all the information they want about a particular thing than it is to look at a bunch of documents and read. It's much easier. And they have discovered film. I'm reading a book right now called Esoteric Hollywood, which is very good.
There.
Yes.
Well, that's a YouTube syndrome where we all have our attention spans shortened by these 10-minute videos that we watch on YouTube. I used to read voraciously, and I don't have an attention span for it any longer.
And that's deliberate. I believe that's deliberate.
I'm sure it is.
Right.
And then they can control. Now they're controlling our YouTube. You know, the YouTube, what do they call it? Content presenters. They're just clearing the decks with of the content providers that they don't like. There's a great big huge purge going on. It's been going on for about a month at YouTube.
Well, they actually made a deal, with the ADL back in 2008, in December 2008, where the ADL was going to come in and give them recommendations of what to accept and what not to accept. And but I think they've really taken a big stand on this, and I think that's why it's very important that people sign that, the petition. And I mentioned at the beginning of the program, it's a petition that will save, or, well, maybe not, to uphold the First Amendment rights. And that petition is linked at my website on today's schedule so that people can click on it and sign it. And it's to uphold First Amendment rights because we need to be able to speak out. And this online censorship is just, it's against the First Amendment. Plain and simple. So I hope everyone will sign that. It's also in the chat room.
Is that a petition to, it's not really, it's a petition to draw the president's attention to this problem? It's not really a petition for, what is it?
It's petition.whitehouse.gov. And it's a petition to the White House to pay attention.
Look into this?
Right.
Okay.
Which?
And you need 100,000 signatures to get them to look at it? And how many they have now? Do you have any idea?
I'm not sure not very many.
No.
Which is very sad.
Okay. Well, yeah, that is sad. And it looks like we're losing our First Amendment. I mean, I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but the way things are going, it doesn't seem like we've got any choice here because nobody listens to the polity anymore. You know what I mean? They just ram it all down our throats.
Sure.
Let the devil take the hindmost. The ADL and the SPLC apparently are both... have been contracted to monitor hate speech, and so they decide what's hateful. And
well, I think
that's a shame.
I think that they also have people who visit websites, chat rooms, and post messages that will limit the rhetoric. They will just limit the rhetoric. And it is very unfortunate. So sometimes we censor ourselves simply because we're afraid to speak out.
How do they limit the rhetoric? I don't get it. You mean they give you a strike? They report your information to the...
No, they just, for instance, if you have a website that you invite comments, person, if you make a comment that is in opposition to what the general article is about, then they can delete it, or they can simply close the comment section, or you can change the subject. There's so many ways of taking people off topic and to ridicule. There's all kinds of ways.
Right. I noticed that in letters to the editors of newspapers at local newspaper websites, they're getting they've been kind of censorious for years, but
decades. Decades and decades.
But now this censorship is infecting platforms, you know, chat rooms and forums and YouTube video channels and Google websites.
Sure. You might have been number one a year ago, and now you might be number
one. Oh, they manipulate those numbers. Exactly.
Sure.
And then there's the demonetization of YouTubers started months ago. So everybody was complaining about not being able to use advertisers to get a little bit of extra money to pay for their channels.
Sure.
Okay, so let's get back to this. So David Irving's critics sought to interpret the episode in their own way, and this Bentinck, you know, that memo. And Sir Richard Evans writes in his account of the Irving-Lipstadt trial that there was no evidence anywhere else, indeed, that the British political warfare executive had invented the story of the gas chambers. Well, Sir Richard Evans is wrong, because Andy Ritchie in his essay went and found, about five gas chamber-related whisper campaigns, fibs, rumors that they planted, and traced those rumors to the various intelligence agencies where they originated, and then pinned them on.
We have a quick 3-minute break, so we'll pick this up on the other side of the break. Be right back. Is Deanna, and our guest today is Charles Kraft. His website is charleskraft.com, and his last name is spelled with two F's. It's K-R-A-F-F-T. Alrighty, I'm sorry I cut you off mid-sentence there in going to the break, but please continue.
I can't remember where I was because I'm back here fussing with my Skype program.
Okay.
But listen, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it later.
Okay. I just wanted to make one mention of something that we'd mentioned, the Nuremberg trials earlier. And the fact is that even before the war ended, Jackson, the judge, was already getting together all of the judges and everything that he needed to have a trial for the Germans. Before the war even ended.
Well, they were looking for some sort of
blame.
Happened. You know about the Raphael Lemkin and the Carnegie Institute for Peace, and they brought him from.
Yes.
He was a Polish they called it a jurist, the guy that writes about jurisprudence, and he came up with he coined the term genocide.
Genocide, right.
And so he coined this term. He applied it to the Armenian, I think the Armenian genocide, and then they used it to for the the German genocide. And the guy that was the legal eagle that took Lemkin's idea of genocide and turned it into a post, ex post facto charge, you see, was Lieutenant Colonel Murray C. Bernays. And
right.
He was Edward Bernays's brother-in-law. His real name was Bernie Cohen. He married Bernays's sister and changed his name Cohen to Bernays because Edward Bernays was such a
popular,
such a well-known New York socialite.
Right.
And so then they had this thing, crimes against humanity and crimes against peace, and that no one had ever been charged with that before. In fact, I don't believe that any were there any trials after World War One? There probably were. I don't know what I don't know anything about it if there were. But as far as I know, these crimes that were concocted by Bernays, the lawyer, and Lemkin, the jurist or the guy that writes about law,
right?
Those were applied. Those crimes weren't even on the books. They just invented them to pin
sure.
down the Germans.
And they were the objective was that these would be acts that groups commit with the objective of destroying national, ethnic, racial, or religious groups. And I'm thinking, gosh, look at all of the crimes that are now currently being committed in the Middle East. What is that all about, and doesn't that apply? Apparently not. Oops, we're at the top of the hour, so we will be right back in 3 minutes.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Our guest today is Charles Kraft, and his website is charleskraft.com. And we're talking about Lemkin, and they attempted to do this after World War II. There was a fellow by the name of, what was his name? Rappaport. There was a Makowski, who was the editor of the 27-volume Encyclopedia of Criminal Law, which was written between 1931 and 1939. And then there was Emil S. Rappaport. He was a Polish-Jewish lawyer. He was a specialist in criminal law. And they got together, and they decided to look at genocide and war crimes, crimes against humanity, and any war of aggression. And so they got they founded the International Association of Penal Law in Paris in 1924. So they were really ramping up for this way before.
Hmm. So that was after World War One that they began to think about,
right.
Think about a charge to use it on the Second World War?
I think so.
Huh. Anyway, I was going to say that this Andy Ritchie, the author of the essay that we're discussing, he pins the rumors. First, he proves that rumors were launched by the SOE, which is the Special Operations Executive, and within the SOE, the PWE, which was the Political Warfare Executive. And he proves that they started off with a rumor on December 3rd, 1940, that the superintendent of the Bethel Institute for Incurables had been sent to Dachau for refusing to permit the inmates to be put in lethal gas chambers. Within 2 weeks, it was reported that this rumor was circulating in Switzerland. And on the 19th of December, that the Vatican had issued a decree condemning the killing of physical or mental deficients. The rumor has appeared in intercepted letters, and last Sunday, this is a quote, the Sunday Express carried the story that 100,000 mental deficients had been executed. Well, The Bethel Institution was a well-known Protestant charitable hospital for the mentally ill and epileptics. In fact, its director, Protestant theologian Frederick von Bodelswing, was not sent to Dachau or any other camp. He survived the war and he died in 1946. So they started the rumor that mental patients and other incurables were being dispatched at Dachau. And that was an untrue rumor, which led to, you know, the T4 program, where there were some euthanasia. Some people were euthanized. I mean, that, I don't think that can be denied. But what can be denied is that they were euthanized with gas. If they were euthanized at all, they were given a coup de grace injection in order to put them to sleep. And that was stopped by a Catholic archbishop who publicized it in the in Germany, and so Hitler put a stop to that when he found out about it. And
So he was not—he's not the—he didn't initiate that.
No, he didn't initiate it at all. And then once it was brought to his attention, he put a stop to it. But they do use the T4 euthanasia program to back up their story about gas chambers in the Action Reinhardt camps of Poland. I think Christian Wirth, who they say was in charge of gassing the Hungarian transports at Treblinka, he worked at T4, so in the T4 program.
Right.
In what capacity, I don't know. You know, he could have been just a bureaucrat sitting at a desk who was moved someplace else. But that sort of the story is that they began killing people. The people they began killing were mental patients and severely handicapped and retarded people. And then they moved, you know, into killing undesirables, racial undesirables, and other kinds of undesirables.
But and who decides who's undesirable? Wow.
Well, yeah. I don't know. So Ritchie found these found evidence that of this rumor. There was another rumor that he found evidence for that soldiers, wounded Germans. See, morale operations is a department of both the OSS and the PWE. When they say morale operations, they mean demoralize.
Right.
So they're demoralizing the Germans, they're demoralizing the army, and they're using rumors and propaganda to do this. And so another sieve, or, you know, they call, these guys called it a sieve.
Right. It sounds kind of innocuous, kind of benign. It doesn't. It sounds kind of benign.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, it's a benign thing. That's another thing about semantics. When people use words that they make what they're doing sound good through semantic legerdemain.
Sure.
I would call it.
Sure. Like the word gay used to mean that you were happy. Oh, we had a gay time.
Yeah.
Means something totally different.
Totally. One of the SIPs that they launched was that in France, military hospitals, German soldiers that were wounded were being euthanized. So this was circulating, a rumor that was circulating. And, of course they weren't euthanizing their wounded. They were trying to do what, they were trying to, attend to their wounded. But the British wanted the Germans to think that if they got too severely damaged in the on the battlefield, that they could expect to be euthanized if, once they were taken you know, to hospital. And let's see what else we got here. One of the sibs was that guards and superintendents of trains containing wounded German soldiers from the Eastern Front, that would be Russia up there or Eastern Europe, are ordered at certain places to put on their gas masks, and the trains are then entered into a tunnel where they remain for upwards of half an hour. On leaving the tunnel, all the wounded soldiers are dead. Severely wounded soldiers are disposed of in the same manner in so-called emergency hospitals, of which there are many. So they have a trainload of wounded, and they pull into a shed and fill the shed up with Zyklon B, apparently, and then when the train leaves, everybody on it has been dispatched. That was another sib. Then they had another one that they used in 1941 that claimed that Germans had ordered 500 mobile crematorium units from the Ford Works in Cologne and Antwerp to be ready by the spring. This sib came back in the form of a story circulating in France that the German army has crematory ovens installed in lorries and cremates all their own dead. This enables the Germans to fix a figure for their losses at whatever they please and leave no evidence to controvert them. Later, an intercepted Swiss letter showed a variant of this rumor that the Germans burn their dead in traveling crematoria and keep their losses carefully concealed until the campaign is ended. Well, that's a lie.
Oh, my gosh.
And then they've got this thing with IG Farben, the giant German pharmaceutical conglomerate, and they launched a sib that said that there is a conviction throughout the country that the Germans are attempting to ruin the health of the French people by sending back French sick and wounded prisoners inoculated by Germans with the bacilli of disease, while there have been rumors of the flooding of the French market with German drugs producing certain forms of debility. So they're claiming that the IG Farben is poisoning the French.
There was also another stupid story that the Germans were cutting down all the apple trees in France. Did you ever hear that story?
No, but that sounds like it's from the same source, you know, this PWE, political warfare executive.
As if soldiers are going to take time to cut down all the apple trees just so that the French will starve. Just really ridiculous ideas.
Here's one that said that the typhus had become so bad among the German army that Jewish physicians had been called up for service as army medics. And they wore surgical masks to conceal their Jewishness.
Oh, gosh.
Because the soldiers apparently were so anti-Semitic that having to be worked on by a Jewish doctor would upset them, you know. So here they are introducing this kind of anti-Semitic stuff into their rumor mill, right?
Sure.
And the thing to remember is when they began all this, the Jews were not... The ones that were the victims. And so Andy Ritchie suspects, and I do too, that Jewish NGOs and charities such probably picked up on these sibs that were being circulated and just created some of their own, you see.
Sure.
And then it became it morphed into, well, they're only killing Jews. But when it started, they were killing German soldiers, French civilians, and such. You know, the Jews weren't, it wasn't a racial thing until later.
Mm-hmm.
The Underground Propaganda Committee approved another one of gas vans and trains used only for plague cases and are really merciful since the poor fellows would have no chance anyhow. They're picking up typhus victims and wounded and on putting them on trains and taking them out the way I just mentioned with the shed full of gas. rounding up healthy Russian prisoners and transferring them in batches of 1,000 at a time to prison camp near Kiev. And it may be a coincidence that cans of something called Russian beef are already being exported from a factory near Kiev.
Oh, my gosh.
The most hard-hit parts of the Ruhr. So there, this is cannibalism rumors, you see.
Sure.
That they're feeding dead Russians to people in Kiev. Later in the month, a note from the War Office Deputy Director of Operations, Colonel John Sinclair, who became Chief of MI6, to David Bowes-Lyon, who was the part of the Underground Propaganda Committee. They said that the Germans need every hospital they have got for their own wounded, so foreign workers who fall seriously sick are just sent to the gas chambers. They don't have any room.
There were more Americans returned from being in a German prison camp. I think it was 99% of them returned back to this country.
Yeah. Yeah, they were treated pretty well. They were treated according to the
Geneva Convention.
Yeah, Geneva Convention. The Germans were, they were very good about that, you know?
Yes.
And
in any war, there's going to be a lot of typhus. There's going to be a lot of disease because things, water filtration systems get bombed and, all kinds of things happen and people are living in tents. You're going to have a lot of disease. And that goes back to even the Civil War. That more people died in the Civil War due to disease than they did from the enemy.
Yeah, you know, have you seen those Civil War photos of Andersonville prisoners?
Yes.
Well, listen, those guys have typhus. That's why they're so skinny.
Yes, exactly.
And that's whenever you see these human skeletons in a war situation, you can bet that the reason why they look the way they do is because they have diarrhea.
Yes.
They can't keep any food in their systems.
That's right. That's right. I wrote about Andersonville and other things relative to that in my first book in my trilogy. And it's a lot of disease. War causes a lot of disease.
Yeah. So whenever, like I said, I mean, I first saw human skeletons in pictures of Andersonville before I ever even started looking closely at World War II and the Holocaust.
And so the Cyclone B was really something that would benefit, that would help people because they were sterilizing the clothes.
And
the bedding. That's why they gave them new clothes when they came into the camps. If they were going to kill them, they wouldn't have tattooed them. They wouldn't have given them real showers. They wouldn't have given them clean clothes if they were going to kill them all. But
no,
they were sterilizing the clothes, sterilizing everything that came in to keep the incidence of disease down.
Right. Okay, so I'm just going to skip these other rumors. We don't have to go into them. Just know that what has been proven by this new research paper is that Dr. Richard Evans has, let's see, with so many gaps in the documentary record, I'm just going to skip down to the end of this thing. British propaganda's invention of a lethal chamber aspect to euthanasia could in this context be seen as the basis for later accretions of the myth. So he's saying that, that this propaganda about euthanasia led to propaganda about Holocaust. So with so many gaps in the documentary record, we might never know precisely how these stories were built up. What we can say is that existing SOE and PWE records fatally undermine one of Professor Richard Evans's arguments against David Irving. As noted above, Evans wrote, "There was no evidence here or anywhere else, indeed, that the British political warfare executive had invented the story of the gas chambers." I mean, they did, and this guy proves it, so.
Right.
That opens a door to other kinds of black ops and the lazing of the British intelligence apparatus with the American intelligence apparatus via the OSS, you know.
Oh, yes.
And so I'm going to tell you a story. You've got C.D. Jackson and Bill Paley going to meetings in London with this guy, Victor Cavendish Bentinck, who was the ninth Duke of Portland, and then his friends who were relatives of Elizabeth, like her uncle was at the head of one of these intelligence committees. And so when I was researching Robert Bruce Lockhart, I was interested in him because he had been a spy that had tried to kill Lenin, and he was sort of a swashbuckler, and he knew Sidney Reilly and all that. And during the First World War and during the Bolshevik Revolution, he was working for British intelligence, and he was sent on a mission to kill Lenin, and he failed, but he wrote a book about it. And then he was called back to run the PWE in World War II. And I was in London, and I went over to Kew Gardens, which is a...
Oh, that's exciting. All righty, we'll be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Charles Kraft. His website is charleskraft.com, and that is spelled K-R-A-F-F-T. And you were over in England, and you went to, go ahead.
I went to the National Archives at Kew, which is a really nice facility that they've redesigned, and it's where you can go and do, you know, if you want to get into primary research, which is going to archives instead of just reading books.
Right.
That's a great place to start looking up things. And so what they ask you to do there is to apply for a card, which they issue you in a matter of minutes, and then you can start looking through their catalog and such for whatever it is that you want to research. And I was particularly interested in what they had on Sir Robert Bruce Lockhart, who was the head of the PWE. And it turns out that Lockhart's papers were at a university somewhere else, and I think it was Manchester. So I couldn't access all of the papers that he had left. But they did have a folder of miscellaneous correspondence, which I ordered up. Give the number.
Right, close stacks.
Yeah. And then you give them a number, and then the person goes and gets this bond, they call it, and it's a folder with the information you're looking for in it. And I was brought this folder of miscellaneous correspondence of Robert Bruce Lockhart.
Right.
And I opened it up, and the first thing in that folder, these are loose letters. It's like it was a variety of miscellaneous letters written by him to various people. And the first thing that was there was that a printed notice from the head archivist of Kew Gardens that 8 documents in the folder had been deemed forgeries and had been removed.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And so then the identification numbers of the forgeries were given. And I didn't have time, unfortunately, because I was on my way out of England the next day. And this was kind of a last-minute thing I was doing. I didn't have time to go back and investigate the forgery situation there.
Sure.
But what I did find was a letterhead and some letters about something which I don't remember, and I didn't have time to copy these letters either. But on the letterhead were the people – that the letter was going to, and the two names that popped out to me were C.D. Jackson and William Paley.
Wow.
So it was some department where Lockhart is sending notices, you see, that are going to be picked up by these two guys. And then there's other names. The letter had about 12 names on it. But since I know who William Paley was and I was familiar with C.D. Jackson, I thought, wow, this is great because it looks like these American spies are working with these British spies. And I went to try to get a copy of the damn letter, and I couldn't figure out, it's like my Skype thing, I couldn't figure out the copy machine. It's a coin-operated thing, and it does all this stuff that you've got to kind of teach yourself on the spot. And they were closing the archive at 5 o'clock, and I hadn't gotten there until about 3, and I did manage to make a copy of the letterheads. And, damn it, I left them at my friend's house on my way out of town.
Oh, dear.
But they're there for anybody that is interested in going back and looking at Robert Bruce Lockhart's miscellaneous correspondence. And I'm sorry, but I don't remember the name of the agency that the letterhead was for. I don't know if it was PWE, SOE, or PWD would be Psychological Warfare Department.
Sure.
Which was U.S., you know.
Sure.
But anyway, it's obvious that that those guys were working together. And there's books about the OSS in London that people can order up and read.
Right.
And those guys were attached to the OSS.
Yes. We're going to take a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back, and we'll talk about the OSS. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Charles Kraft. His website is charleskraft.com. And you were talking about some of the other the issues of the propaganda. Yes, Office of Strategic Services. But even before they became an entity, there was a smear campaign against Hitler on August the 26th. 1933, in it's called the Literary Digest, and this was in England, compared him to Charles Chaplin, and with his characteristic mustache and his bouncing way of walking, and a writer in the London New Statesman commented, and I quote, "He was so funny, I inquired who he might be, and suggested that Hitler was probably a trifle mentally deranged." And as Hitler's reputation was growing stronger in Germany, a lot of the European newspapers highlighted what they viewed as the comic aspects of Germany's dictator. They called him Germany's dictator. And this was in 1933. He no sooner was elected, and yes, he was elected, they started marginalizing him, demonizing him, portraying him as a comedian, just all kinds of things. There was another fella by the name of Hermann Rauschning.
Hermann Rauschning,
yes,
was the mayor of Danzig, and he was a liar.
Yes.
You know Hitler Speaks was proven to be fraudulent.
Yes.
You know that?
Yes.
So,
he also wrote a book defaming Germany. It was German propaganda, not so-called Nazi propaganda, and he wrote The Voice of Destruction, and that was published in New York by
G.P. He was working with the OSS, obviously.
Yes.
And
he moved to America in 1941.
He died in Oregon.
Yes, in Portland, near Portland.
Yeah, I know. It's just been determined, well, not just, but they're saying now that Hitler's table talk is a fraud. Have you heard that?
No, haven't.
Yeah, that You know, Veronica Kuzner Clark.
Yes.
She's written an essay at Inconvenient History about Hitler's table talk, but it was actually discovered to be a. She's written about this case of its fraudulence. She didn't discover its fraudulence, but she writes about the man that did discover the fraudulence. And this guy is some sort of a Christian historian. And it turns out that Hugh Trevor Roper got the manuscript from this guy named Jeannot in Switzerland, who had the copyright. And then it turns out that the guys that took down Hitler's table talk, they weren't at the table. You got to read this because this is great. These two mainstream sources that are all you'll always find them quoted in books on World War II about Hitler. They're both they're not true.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It's right.
Like they've been exposed as being sort of disinformation. Put it that way.
Right. Go ahead.
Pardon? You go ahead.
Well, he claimed that Hitler had a Nazi blueprint of the world. He claimed all kinds of things. And as you mentioned, he wrote Hitler Speaks, and it was a series of political conversations with Adolf Hitler on his real aims. And he also published Hitler's Aims in War and Peace, 1940, published in London, and Hitler Wants the World in 1941. And he claimed that he knew what Hitler was thinking, and he tells all these ridiculous stories that he couldn't possibly know, and yet people believe this.
Well, he lifted some of that stuff out of a novel, too. Did you know that? It turned out. Somebody, I read something somewhere where they're actually comparing some of Rauschening's text to
Emery Reeves, he wrote a book.
About exposing Rauschening?
Well, he wrote the original, let's see, the original French edition of Hitler Speaks.
Oh,
and then,
okay. But they've tracked Rauschening's lies to other books. You know, he just lifted parts of other books and cobbled together these conversations. And some of the conversations were conversations from novels, you know, that he just turned around. And
oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get back to this other. I know about Rauschening, and I'm really happy about Hitler's table talk. I mean, that was a really
big deal.
Hugh Trevor Roper, you know, he did it
sure.
for money because he had the he bought the copyright from the Swiss guy Jeannot that ended up with the copyright from Mein Kampf.
Oh.
Anyway, so the OSS. You know that the Frankfurt School was brought into the OSS by Wild Bill Donovan, those
yes.
Marxists?
Yes, he was
so,
there, yes.
Yeah, and so they're using these Marxists committed to, cultural Marxism to gather evidence at Nuremberg. Herbert Marcuse helped design the Nuremberg trials. I don't know if many people know that. And then Franz Naumann was tasked to collect all kinds of evidence of Nazi depredations against the Christian churches. And
it's so untrue. Oh, my gosh. In fact, more Christian churches were established and constructed during Hitler's time in power than ever before.
Naumann was going around trying to make a case against it so that he could have the evidence there for the prosecutors at Nuremberg. And
wow.
I don't know, but Marcuse, the guy that started that Make Love Not War meme in the 60s. I saw him in San Francisco at an anti-Vietnam march, you know. And he was actually there at Nuremberg in a top position, putting together the structure of the trial itself.
Wow.
I wanted to get to this other thing that's pretty important for people to know about intelligence and World War II and the Holocaust. Did you know about the Ritchie boys? I want to ask you that question.
Yeah.
Did you know about Camp Ritchie in Maryland where I just went to the Wikipedia entry for it, and when I first discovered the Ritchie boys, that they said that there were 10,000 Ritchie boys trained at Camp Ritchie, Maryland. These are Jewish refugees, multilingual, who were trained in psychological warfare there. Then I went back just before our conversation to phone up on some of this stuff, and now the number they've got at the Wikipedia entry for Ritchie boys is 15,000. So here we have, and it says right there at the entry, primarily Jewish. Can you open up a page and look at that?
I did. The Ritchie boys consisted of approximately 15,200 servicemen who were trained for U.S. Army intelligence during World War II at the secret Camp Ritchie training facility.
Yeah.
Approximately 14%, or 2,200 of them, were Jewish refugees born in Germany and Austria.
Oh, it says 14% now. No, they changed it. They changed the number and they changed the percentage of Jews.
Okay, what was it before?
Well, they didn't have a percent. I don't remember a percent. It just said mostly Jewish when I first discovered 10,000 mostly Jewish.
Mostly, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, anyway, go on.
Which could be 85%. Most of the men sent to Camp Ritchie for training were assigned there because of fluency in German, French, Italian, Polish, and other languages needed by the U.S. Army during World War II. They had been drafted into or volunteered to join the United States Army, and when their ability to speak the languages of the enemy were discovered, they were sent to Camp Ritchie on secret orders. Some of the Jewish refugees who were part of the program had originally arrived in the U.S. as children, many without their parents, and were also among the 1,000 children. One such OTC was Ambassador Richard Schifter. Well, this is very interesting.
Okay, so there's some sort of a kinder transport that we haven't been told about, because all we ever hear about is St. Louis getting turned back from Havana Harbor with that, you know, the refugee Jews aboard. But
right.
I think people need to know that refugee Jews were coming into the country from Mexico. They were coming down from Canada. They were getting in from Cuba. And they just sort of slipped in.
And this was pre-war. This was before the war.
Yeah, this is when before the war broke out. You see, the Germans are making it difficult. What the Germans did, they just want to. They wanted to. You know what?
They wanted to take care of their country. They wanted to feed their families. They wanted Germany to be for Germans.
And yeah, exactly.
After World War One, there was a whole bunch of people from the East that came in and bought up all this land at pennies on the dollar, and they had taken over so much. And when Hitler came in, he decided that he was going to do for the Germans what any leader should do for the citizens. And that was
out all the professions, which were top heavy with Jews, is one of the things he did. And so these people that suddenly were no longer employable because they were Jewish, they started leaving the country in, what, 38, would you say? They're just heading out.
Even before. There were a lot of them, I think, that left as soon as Hitler came in. And yeah, we know that Berlin, all the people that had destroyed Berlin and made it the immoral place that it was, they all left and came to went to Hollywood.
Yeah, there was a lot in Hollywood, refugees. And, but Gentiles too, like Thomas Mann and his brother. I can't remember his brother's name. But there's a whole bunch of communists, Bertolt Brecht, you know, he was in Hollywood. There was a
Brecht,
bunch of,
oh yes, yes, yes.
There was a whole bunch of refugees there. A lot of them were Jewish. And then they were kind of leaning towards communism. But anyway, so we got the Ritchie boys, and they're being trained in psychological warfare at Camp Ritchie. And then they're being sent back, and they're spreading, they're spreading disinformation, and they're trying to demoralize the German army with, mobile radio stations and pamphlets that they print.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing, leaving them around, trying to get them to surrender. And, give themselves up and promising them that, this and that. And then the war is finally ended. And then what the Ritchie boys are next tasked with is the denazification of Germany, which means they have to teach the Germans, they have to replace everything that, the media has to be, re-engineered political structure has to be re-engineered, and the Ritchie boys are there helping this re-engineering operation, and they're put into positions of
education, media,
communications and media, and then they're clerks of ferreting out Nazis from political positions, Gauleiters and such, from town.
Right.
And, anybody that had anything to do with the regime was ferreted out and punished. Punished with unemployment, let's put it that way. Okay, so we got those guys doing social engineering. And then I wanted to mention this other group, and these guys are psychological warriors, by the way. Oh, they're interrogators. They were at Nuremberg. These are the guys, about Malmedy and when Pieper
and his men
were tortured, and then Joe McCarthy went over there and found out that they'd had their gonads stomped on.
Yes.
And that one kid hung himself, and they were torturing confessions out of these officers and soldiers. Well, those are the Ritchie boys. Those are the interrogators. And so, they were used to torture, confessions out of the high ranking POWs. And, they were merciless and they were mad because of course they had this, ethnic animus against Germans.
Sure.
And what had happened, because they had come from Europe and they had been inconvenienced and jailed, some of them, by Germans. They hated the Germans, but the German animus was already they were already full of German animus before the boom was lowered on Jews in Germany. I mean, it was percolating, in the, international Jewish community with that boycott on Germany, remember that?
Sure.
That appeared before the war.
Right.
So these guys have a bone to pick. I mean, it's not like they're unbiased. They're very biased and they're full of rage and they want vengeance for what happened to them and what happened to their parents. So they're not going to give the captured Germans any quarter. And so that's the Ritchie boys, and what I noticed is that their children now are coming out with books about their father's time as Ritchie boys, so you can pick up the memoirs of these guys.
All righty, we're going to take a 3-minute break. We'll be right back. today is Charles Kraft. His website is charlescraft.com. I was just reading up a little bit about the Ritchie Boys from Wikipedia. Some of the stuff there is true. But, of course, they, as you mentioned, as you called our attention to, it has been edited quite a bit.
Yeah, did you go to...
On those wiki entries,
you can just put that talk button, find out what kind
right,
of edits have been made.
Yeah,
it gets edited all the time.
Sure.
So we got the Ritchie Boys, and there's, well, now that they say 15,000, but somewhere between 10 and 15,000, let's say. I mean, we can depend on that figure, I think.
But there was another group. Amazing what they did. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, nobody knows about these guys. I mean, it's incredible because, we're not told. And, unless you're interested in intelligence, you never find out.
Sure.
Because they don't factor into, revisionism research, but they're there. And once you find out about them, you start to understand how the Holocaust legend got its legs, right?
Sure.
There's another group that people should be aware of, and they're called the Bergson Boys. And these are about, I would say, less than 10 Jewish propagandists who formed a cell in Washington, D.C. under a man named Peter Bergson, whose real name was Hillel Kook.
Oh, right.
He was the son of the Ashkenazi rabbi of Palestine.
Right.
There was no Israel. And he was a militant Zionist Irgun operative. And what these guys did with Peter Bergson, they
How
say
do you
that,
explain that?
What?
B-E-R-G.
B-E-R-G-S-O-N.
Okay.
Bergson Boys. They're called the Bergson Boys.
Right, and that's Peter Bergson. And
yeah.
He was the Ergen's agent in America. And he was
yes,
with Hecht.
He was. Pardon me?
Ben Hecht. He worked with Ben Hecht.
Well, Ben Hecht was an Academy Award winning Hollywood screenwriter who worked with Peter Bergson planting atrocity stories in the media.
Right.
And they just make this crazy stuff up, and you read about it in Reader's Digest or anywhere where they were planting stories. And Bergson had connections to all the Jewish organized Jewry in America. It would be the probably the ADL, and then the American Jewish Committee, and then dozens of these things. He knew all those people, plus he knew everybody in Hollywood, and he knew all the gangsters, too. And one of the things that we don't realize is that...
We're at the top of the hour, and we'll be right back in 3 minutes. Anna, and our guest today is Charles Kraft. His website is charlescraft.com, and we were talking about Peter Bergson, whose real name was Hillel Kook, K-O-O-K, of Jerusalem, and he came into the United States in 1940, and he created the Emergency Committee to Save the Jewish People of Europe. And he worked with Ben Hecht. Okay.
Well, there was others. I'm looking at this site where you can buy an academic account of the Bergson Boys, and the title is "The Bergson Boys and the Origins of Contemporary Zionist Militancy."
Wow.
They're militant Zionists. There's six young men, emissaries of the revisionist Zionist Irgun military movement in Palestine, revolutionized the American Jewish and Zionist scene. And the author goes into how they used the media, you know, and taught their co-religionists and then allies how to
hate,
how to use the media. Anyway, having energized politicians, gangsters, Hollywood moguls, and ultra-Orthodox rabbis, the handful of young men taught other Zionist and American Jewish groups not only how the media was the message, but how it could and should be used. A guiding force behind the creation of the War Refugee Board, the group served as a beacon for contemporary Zionist militancy while ultimately laying the groundwork for other organizations to utilize the media in future political campaigns. So these guys are pioneers in propaganda, correct?
Yes.
And revisionist Zionism is that Zabotinsky Likud stuff, you know. It's ultra-right rather than left.
Right.
Zionism, militant. And Peter Bergson, as I said, according to the blurb, he energized politicians, gangsters, Hollywood moguls, and rabbis. So there were rallies, and there was lots of, you know, Hecht was planning stories in Reader's Digest, and Bergson was running around from office to office trying to muster up rescue help for Jewish refugees, you know.
Right.
Basically. And at the same time, he's promoting the idea that I assume he's promoting the idea that they're being dispatched in gas chambers.
Gas chambers, right. And this was when Ben Hecht wrote this article for Reader's Digest. That was in February of 1943. And he was using this Dr. Greenberg's statistics regarding the Jewish population figures for various countries in Europe. And so everything is just, it's all propaganda. And Heck claimed that of the 6 million Jews that the Germans had already killed, 2 million. And
yeah,
that was in
1943. They hadn't even gotten to the camps weren't liberated until 45. So what does he know about anything?
It's all propaganda. Lies.
Yeah. And, Hecht wrote another book later after the war called Perfidy. And that's an interesting book because he got mad at the Zionists. And I can't really tell you. It had something to do with a transfer agreement, you know, with Joel Eichmann and those people in Palestine that were going to trade trucks for Jews or something like that. I can't remember exactly the details, but he felt he'd been hoodwinked by Zionists, and he wrote a book about it called Perfidy. But that was later. That was in the 50s. Another guy I want to just get at, and people don't know this at all, and this is fascinating. The head of the United States Army Department of War Crimes was a Jewish lieutenant named David Mickey Marcus. And David Mickey Marcus was at Nuremberg, and he was in charge of Nuremberg, and I think he was also probably in charge of whatever went on with the Japanese prisoners, the Japanese trials, although I don't know anything about what he did in Japan. But he was definitely in Nuremberg. He was definitely in charge of the war crimes department for the U.S. Army. And after they hung the defendants, he was offered a brigadier general upgrade from lieutenant colonel, and he refused it. And what he did was he changed his name, and he slipped out of the United States, and he went to Palestine and became the first general in a Jewish army since the Maccabees, 2,000 years before.
Wow.
So he went in to train the
Israeli defense?
Israeli defense forces, yeah. But he was there before there were Israeli defense forces, so what he was what he was working with were the the air gun, the PAL match, and these terrorist cells. I say terrorist because that's where the word came from originally, from Palestine and the terror attacks on Palestinians that were carried out by Jewish Zionist commando units. So he went to Palestine, worked with the commandos, and then when Israel was declared a state, he became a general in the IDF, and they credited him with training the first Jewish army since the Maccabees. Well,
and what was his name?
Lieutenant
Marcus.
David Mickey Marcus.
Okay, all righty.
And Kirk Douglas made a movie about this back in, I think it was like 1973 or something. Yeah, no, Kirk Douglas, Neil Brenner, and Angie Dickinson, and
yes, Cast a Giant Shadow.
Yeah, Cast a Giant Shadow. So he's a he's a hero. But the deal is that he was fragged on his way back to he didn't speak. I guess he didn't speak Hebrew, and I don't believe the story. But the story is a sentry shot him by accident on his way back to camp one night. It seems preposterous, but maybe he was I don't know, maybe he was assassinated for some reason, who knows, but he is buried in the West Point cemetery.
Oh.
And he is the only soldier in that cemetery that died fighting for a foreign flag. Everybody else at West Point fought for U.S. flag. But David Mickey Marcus was fighting for the Israeli flag. And the question is, what uniform is he buried in? Israeli or American?
Sure.
I don't know. I would assume probably American. But that's a piece of post-war history that is pretty interesting because he could have been a brigadier general, but instead he wanted to go and help with the help.
Right, the 1948 Arab-Israeli War.
Yeah. Right.
Hmm.
He wanted to help getting Israel off the ground, which everybody wanted to. Everybody involved who is Jewish in this and these intelligence.
Right.
And these intelligence, the world of intelligence was, I assume they're Zionist, you know, and they're working towards this goal, which is an Israeli state, you know, homeland for the Jews in the Middle East.
Sure. Every time I hear the name Kirk Douglas, I always think of the story of what he did to Natalie Wood.
What did he do?
And, people are going to have to look it up. Just what Kirk Douglas did to Natalie Wood. It was pretty bad.
I once.
It's a piece of garbage.
Well, you know, he's famous for breaking the blacklist and letting Dalton Trumbo's name be used as a writer's credit for Spartacus.
Mm-hmm.
And then all those, the Hollywood 10 got to sort of their careers back after the QAC hearings in Hollywood where they were actually jailed for, they went to jail for a year, I think. Right? They were all communists, by the way. I mean,
right.
It's like they took the fifth because they were card-carrying communists.
Sure.
And I think they lied. They went to jail for lying, I bet. That's why. And then when they did a year, they came out. And then they're back in business. And Kirk Douglas helped Dalton Trumbo,
right.
Who was one of them.
The government can lie to you, but you can't lie to the government.
Yeah. I saw Kirk Douglas he was signing his book at the department store in Seattle where I live. And I happen to have a poster of him in the movie Lust for Life. He plays Vincent Van Gogh. And I took the poster downtown and had him sign the poster for me. and now I've lost it. So I don't know.
There's probably no great loss, right?
Well, in the world of ephemera movie, memorabilia, that I could put that on the market and make a little money.
Sure, maybe you could find it again.
If I find it, I can't find it.
Be sure and sell it. I had a copy of, can't even think of his name, Elie Wiesel's book that was signed. And because I met this guy. I met him. I went to a meeting, and he was promoting his book. And, just interesting.
You still have it?
No. I got rid of it. Gladly got rid of it.
He was another sort of fraudulent guy, you know?
He was very fraudulent. Oh, nothing but a fraud. I couldn't have the book in the house. I just couldn't.
Yeah.
And he was typical.
Hey, let me get back to C.D. Jackson, because I'm sort of stuck on this guy because he's a mystery, and I want to go through some things that he's famous for. I mean, that he's known for. And I'm just gonna. There's a list I made. I sent you this list. I'm gonna go through it, and then.
Okay. Yeah, I've got the list.
I want people to understand that there is no biography of him. There is a student thesis that was written by a teacher of history, I guess, in New York. But it doesn't cover his World War II, war work. It begins after the war when he gets involved with them.
That's convenient, huh?
Yeah, it's convenient. And so there's nothing about Buchenwald or any of that stuff. But so he orchestrated that PSYOP at Buchenwald with Billy Wilder, who was there to film it. And,
right. Who went over there before anything happened. He was there probably in, what, April?
I don't
or
know.
Or even March.
There's a book that this guy wrote. It's called Five Came Back. It's about five Hollywood directors
who
worked. Did you read that book?
Yeah.
John Ford, George Stevens, John Huston, William Wyler, and Frank Capra.
Yeah.
They all got naval commissions. The funny thing about it is they were given these Navy whites, which they really liked to get themselves into, because they looked so snappy, and they were hanging around the Beverly Hills racket club, you know, in their Navy whites.
Mm-hmm.
they didn't do any basic training or anything. They were just sort of brought in and given a
sure, put on this uniform.
Yeah.
Well, and Billy Wilder was Austrian-born. He wasn't even born in the United States.
Right. Yeah, I know. And then another person that was involved in making propaganda movies was Alfred Hitchcock. He was.
Oh, yes.
He was involved in that, too.
Yes.
And what they did was, like I say, it's creative editing when it comes to the Holocaust, guys. And, listen to this. They even staged some Pacific War naval battles in Hollywood studios. You know what I mean? They recreated it, and then they led you to believe that this was footage from the front. You know?
Right.
It wasn't. And also, there was a guy up in New Jersey that had a studio that was doing the March of Time, and he was employing actors dressed in Nazi uniforms to make actors that were dressed as Jews sweep streets and do this these menial tasks that were then put into the newsreels and shown in movie houses across the country.
Wow.
So there was a lot of movie fakery going on. But these guys mm-hmm. did actually go into – they traveled to Europe and they captured some of the – I mean, I can't say that what they did was all false, because it wasn't, but they did falsify some of their they're
and, reporting. And the reason why people were in such horrid shape was because of all the Allied bombing.
Well, there's that, And then another thing I learned is, American soldiers, apparently our army, about a third of it could only read up to a sixth grade level. We had a lot of people that were uneducated that were drafted or volunteered to go into the military. And in order to train these guys, they had to show them movies. So the Hollywood made training films to show soldiers who couldn't read. They could get the information off of a movie and training film, and then they would slip in the disinformation to get them worked up, you see, so that they have a reason to kill, a better reason to kill a German.
Sure.
As they're teaching them how, they're giving them the why. And a lot some of that stuff is just propaganda. So back to C.D. Jackson, of course, he does that Nuremberg. I mean, he does the psyops at
Buchenwald.
Buchenwald, and then that evidence that was photographed is handed over to Thomas Dodd, who was a prosecutor at Nuremberg, and he unveils that head, and there's a big gasp, in the peanut gallery when he tells the assembly that the commandant of Buchenwald is shrinking heads. That's just ridiculous, but they believed it. And he was made a senator as a result of all his at Nuremberg. Okay, so then Jackson comes home, and he's involved in the Kennedy assassination. And he buys Abraham Zapruder's film. 24 hours of the assassination, he's got his hands on the Zapruder film. And then he sits on it. By this time, he's at Life magazine. And he signed a book deal with Marina Oswald, which was ghostwritten by a CIA agent named Levine. Something like Ivy Levine.
Mm-hmm.
I guess. I can't remember. But I remember the last name. I think his name was Ivy Levine or something. But anyway, he ghostwrote Marina Oswald's biography. And Jackson... presented her with a publishing contract, which was substantial. And there was other payouts to members of her family and Oswald's brother. So he's there. That he founded Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, which was broadcasting American propaganda behind the Iron Curtain after it dropped.
Mm-hmm.
He established the Bilderberg Group. And he attended all the Bilderberg meetings up until 1964 when he died of a heart attack. I don't know where he died, but I do know that he lived at the Dakota, which was where John Lennon and Yoko Ono lived. And he died a couple of years, 1964. He died a couple of years before John Lennon was shot in front of that place. He went to Rome with Henry... Luce and Claire Booth Luce and Charles Courtney Murray, who was a Catholic journalist who worked for Time magazine. And they helped change the 2,000-year-old dogma of the Catholic Church during Vatican II in 1965. And the upshot of this change was the transference of the onus of the deicide, which means the onus of the crucifixion of Jesus, from the Jews to the Romans. And then the ecumenicism that was a part of that convocation made an opening for Catholic Marxist liberation theology that was later used to exploit South America by... like David Rockefeller, just American business, right?
So
it was that the Holocaust issue was brought up in 1965 with the Catholics, and they were blamed for the Holocaust because of the anti-Semitism of their story about Jews crucifying Christ, you know, the Christ killers. And so there they are working that, you know, to their advantage.
Wow.
And they were assisted in that by Father Malachi Martin, who used to call up.
Right.
Used to call up Art Bell and scare everybody's pants off with those stories at night about exorcisms.
Oh, remember my him? Gosh. I know his name.
Well, he was you have to look into Malachi Martin's, he's a Jesuit, and he worked for Cardinal B, and he was paid by the American Jewish Committee. They've got checks, photographed that he was paid to, influence the cardinals into, changing the dogma of the church.
Wow.
Anyway, you can look that up. That's a very interesting, chapter in Catholic, recent 20th century Catholic history. Not many people know that now the Jews in Catholicism it's taught that, it was the Romans that actually were responsible for the crucifixion. It wasn't the Pharisees.
Oh, gosh.
And that was because of a French rabbi going to the Pope and telling him that anti-Semitism in the Catholic Church was what had caused the Holocaust, and they had to change their doctrine. And then Courtney Murray and Henry and Claire Booth Luce were there with C.D. Jackson, not necessarily to change that particular part of the dogma, but they did want to introduce this ecumenicism and then ecumenicism, which means all religions are equal for Americans. They wanted to spread Americanism.
That was
this, the American century. They believed that, we were going to be the leaders of the, 20th century, which it turned out we were. He lived in the Dakota, where John Lennon lived, but he was dead before John Lennon got shot there. He founded the CIA with William Paley of CBS and Cord Meyer and other guys that were involved in the OSS. The OSS morphed after the war into the CIA. And he debriefed, dig this, America's first UFO abductees, Barney and Betty Hill. These were, this was a black couple that claimed that they'd been picked up by a flying saucer. And,
oh my gosh.
And that was the first time that, this idea that, the aliens are, experimenting on earthlings.
Right.
Popped up. And so there's something about aliens in the CIA. I mean, this is some kind of a psyop too, that there's UFOs out there that are, watching us and studying us and experimenting on us and such. And Barney and Betty Hill were visited by C.D. Jackson. Okay, so I said here that with the exception of a 92-page published master's thesis, very thin, C.D. Jackson, it's called C.D. Jackson, Cold War Propagandist for Democracy and Globalism. It doesn't mention his World War II activities. There's no biography of the man exists. And he's a major player in the 20th century when it comes to psychological warfare. And, I guess they just don't want, I think his papers are closed.
Sure.
The truth. I think because of national security, they're at the Eisenhower Library in Abilene, Texas, along with, Paley's. And I think that I read someplace that you just can't go there and order them up because of national security reasons.
Which is what they always say. Oh, we can't do this because of national security. Oh, well, whose national security are they talking about? They're talking about globalism.
Yeah,
everything
globalism.
That, right. It's, nothing is done in behalf of or for the American citizens. It's all in their objectives, their agenda.
Well, Jackson was one of the premier globalists, and his job after the war was to fuse American corporatism with international foreign policy, and so
right.
he had all kinds of committees and groups that he chaired and sat in on, you know, that resulted now in what we know as this democratic capitalism, which is really corporatism.
Right.
And he was a real serious propagandist for globalism, especially with this Bilderberger group thing that he started. And then he went to the same school. This is a private school called the Hill School, where Donald Trump's sons went, and he also attended a Swiss boarding school. So he was from upper middle class roots. His father was a imported marble, lived in New York City. He was C.D. Jackson Sr. And this gossipy guy that wrote this book about the Dakota, called Living at the Dakota, which is a fun book to read about the people that live there, he claims
that... Birmingham?
Yeah, Birmingham. Did you read that?
I know.
You know about
but
that?
I've read another book that he wrote.
Didn't you write the book about the 400, the Jewish...
yes.
He wrote about the Jewish... leaders in America, the
yes,
aristocrats.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he included the Rockefellers.
Well, I don't get this, because everybody says that they're Jewish and they're not. He was a Baptist, John D. Rockefeller.
Yeah, it's weird. Okay, we're going to take a real quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest today is Charles Kraft. His website is charleskraft.com. And during the break, I grabbed the book off the shelf, The Grandees, The Story of America's Sephardic Elite by Stephen Birmingham. And he makes mention of Rockefeller on page 224. But the implication is that a lot of these people after the so-called Civil War were just waiting to exploit the situation, the economic situation. And the main Jewish person that was really implicated in the Civil War was Judah Benjamin, which I talk about in my first book of the trilogy. And he was from the Sephardic family, which were people who left Portugal and accepted, they changed their names and a lot of the Jews who wanted to stay within the country had to adopt Christianity and whatnot, but that's another story.
Well, Judah Benjamin didn't do that. Judah Benjamin went to Europe after the Civil War, and I think
right, with a lot of gold.
He went to work for the City of London, didn't he, or something like that?
Yes, and he took a lot of gold with him, many, many pounds of gold that he stole.
I don't doubt that. I don't know about him, but I know he didn't convert. But listen to this. So Birmingham.
No, he didn't.
Birmingham says that C.D. Jackson's father's name was Jacobson, and I checked that out, and it wasn't. His father was always, he was named C.D. Jackson as C.D. Jackson II, and his dad was C.D. Jackson I.
Mm-hmm.
He said that in the book, I got all excited, and because he claimed that C.D. Jackson was a crypto-Jew and that he didn't want Jews living at the Dakota, and he told somebody that was in charge of who gets an apartment in that place, that there shouldn't be any Jews there. And then Birmingham says, well, this is strange, because here's a Jew telling the apartment manager that he doesn't want any other Jews to come and live there. And so that business that Birmingham wrote about Jackson's dad is bogus. I checked on that, but he might have been a Michelin because his mother was probably Jewish. That's what I...
That's a possibility.
I looked her up. You know, she's hard to find. I found her after a couple hours, not a couple hours, but I mean, an hour and a half of trying to get a fix on this. And I don't have her maiden name because I forgot to write it down, but she could be Jewish. So maybe Birmingham was half right, okay? But he was totally wrong about this business of Jackson's dad being named Jacobson. One of the guys.
As you said before, you get the most truth when you actually visit such places as the National Archives or the archives in England. That's where you really learn from the source records. Those are primary sources. Books are those are compiled sources. Somebody put these books together, and many of them do not even have any footnotes or any references or attributions or anything.
Right. With academics, they just trade information among themselves, and it becomes an echo chamber.
Sure.
Someone will write something, and the next guy writing a book about it will see what that guy wrote, and he will attribute, you know, his information to that book, and it just goes in a circle.
Sure.
And the thing about David Irving that was unique was that he did go to the archives, and he didn't depend on other people's books to write his histories.
Right.
And he's got to be commended for that, because these academic echo chambers are where disinformation is propagated, you know, in various disciplines. And if you follow Jay Dyer, you know, he talks about this every week. He's onto this, academic echo chambers, and so is Jan Irvin at Gnostic Media. They have discovered CIA cells within college faculties, and they're always neuro-linguistic programmers and psychologists and such like that, and even anthropology weaponized, you know, by the guy that started the CIA. Margaret Mead's husband started the CIA. What was his name? He was an anthropologist. He was in the OSS. I can't remember his name.
My gosh. They're behind so many organizations. Just so many organizations.
I can't Margaret Mead, the anthropologist.
Right.
And
right.
Her husband was a founder of the CIA. He was an anthropologist, and these guys are so smart. They all come out of Ivy League colleges, and they're just smart as whips. Then they get, you know, they get inducted into these programs where they get money to do it. You know, they get paid to do this.
Sure.
That's the deal.
Yeah.
The money's good, so they go along with it.
Sure, and yes. Luther Cressman was her first husband. He died, she wasn't married to him very long. Then she married, her second husband, Rio Fortune.
No, third husband, that much.
Gregory Bateson.
Bateson, yeah, that's him. Gregory Bateson.
Yes.
If you look up the history of the CIA, Gregory Bateson is one of the premier members. And he was in the OSS during the war, and they study populations, you know, these anthropologists.
Sure.
And they figure out how they can manipulate
them.
Kill them, but actually...
manipulate them more.
Manipulation comes before murder with these guys. But the murder, you know, often happens too.
Sure.
There was this guy, Alfred de Grazia, I discovered. He is a CIA academic who continued to, after the war, to write white papers on psychological warfare for the CIA. And what's interesting about him is that there's a picture of him that at Dachau standing in front of a pile of corpses. I'm sort of interested in George Stevens and his film crew, and then they come into Dachau. They have to take the shower existing shower room and then retrofit it as a gas chamber so they can make that, you know, make the movie and then send the newsreels back to America and get this Holocaust gassing thing going. And, at Dachau, which we now know there, I mean, I went to Dachau, they had this sign there in the gas chamber that said, never used, in seven languages. I'm sitting in this thing and I look up at the shower head. So they look like they were made by a Mexican tinsmith. I mean, it's so shabby. the way they lowered the ceiling and then put these phony shower heads.
Sure.
There, and then they put these, they got some coal chutes for the walls and punched holes in the walls, and they tell you at the camp that Zyklon B pellets were introduced into that gas chamber by those chutes from the outside.
Sure. Wow. Now, Jerry Brown appointed Bateson to the regents of the University of California, and he was in that position until he died. He died on Independence Day, 1980. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
So
the University of California is a really strange place. I think it yes. isn't Dianne Feinstein, isn't
she's
she now
California.
She's the head of the university. She's the chancellor of the whole state university system.
Holy, I believe. Yeah.
And you know what they pump out? They pump out all this cultural Marxism in Berkeley,
sure.
California. It's poisonous. It's
oh, absolutely.
Place. And it has been ever since the 60s, ever since Mario Savio and the free speech movement. It's been nothing but, you know, a cesspool there of cultural Marxism and, you know, and funny business.
Sure. And I think that the anti-war movement with Vietnam War was really taken over and marginalized and demonized. Because there were people who were against the war, but then they made it out to be that they were a bunch of hippies doing drugs and everything else. So the whole anti-war movement, was, I think, infiltrated. What do you think?
I'm convinced because, they, derailed it with LSD and,
right.
the CIA was the source of the LSD that was being passed out at all the hippie festivals. That's been, that's all been pretty much proven at GnosticMedia.com. That guy,
yes.
Jan
yes.
Urban, has all kinds of evidence of the CIA getting young people out, away from political action events and into navel gazing because
yes.
if they get the hippies high and then fill them with the idea that if they take drugs they're going to have a spiritual experience then they can diffuse the marching, you know, against the war,
right
and that rock and roll and sex, what do they call sex, drugs and rock and roll, that derailed
right.
the anti-war movement, it really did. It kind of,
yes.
It changed it. And that was an operation, obviously. But back to DeGrazia, and, I got his book. He's got this publishing company, and he's self-published. He's dead, but his family, has the copyrights on these books that he's written. And, one of them is his diary, A Taste of War. And, he was a captain in the United States, Army Department of Psychological Warfare, and he was the first guy into Dachau. So I suspect that he got the inmates or somebody else to, retrofit the get ready
oh,
for
sure.
George Stevens. You know what I mean? And we gotta make
sure.
a movie. And so he's coordinating that. And, I have a picture here on of him. Standing in front of all the corpses, on page 481 of his big fat book of 500 pages about him and the war. And I swear to God, there's no text in all of this about what he did at Dachau. That information's missing. There's nothing here about that. And I wrote to his his widow. She runs this thing called Metron Publishing. And I said, hey, did I miss something? I bought A Taste of War, soldiering in World War II, and I said, there's a picture of Alfred de Grazia at Dachau, but I can't find any entries about what he did at Dachau. Can you help me out?
No, I never heard back.
I didn't hear back. You know, silence. So he was up to some sort of psychological psyops, you know, at Dachau. That's him. And there was another guy that I think he was an OSS guy that they let him get picked up, and so he was a prisoner at one of the other camps when they arrived, and he's on film talking about being a prisoner in one of those places, and he's spreading false news as he's being interviewed. He was from California. I can't remember that guy's name, but he was parachuted in at some place, and then he allowed himself to get picked up so he could be a prisoner when the camp got liberated, and then film crews came, and they interviewed him about what went on there, and he told them a bunch of fibs. And that was psych war. He was a psych war guy. And from Hollywood, by the way. He was from Hollywood, California.
Oh, that's helpful.
Yeah. So, essentially my big campaign is to try to get, people that are curious about revisionism, get them to look into intelligence, and because I'm tired of, recycled concentration camp forensics. Everything seems to be, all the research was done, at the Zundel trials, and then we keep getting that stuff fed back to us, and I wish some people with a little bit more vision would check out the spies, because the spies had a lot to do with this.
Sure.
And there was,
think that the things that came out at those two trials were so important, and I think that the revisionists they want so badly for people to look at what was brought out of the trials. They want to make sure that people know. But I think that probably the majority of Americans still believe what they heard first. They heard about the Holocaust, the supposed Holocaust, and that's what they believe. People typically believe what they hear first. There's no retractions. If a newspaper makes a retraction, it's always on the back page.
Yeah, right. I've had my eye on this since I got involved in it maybe 15 years ago, and this is before YouTube was the place to go for this information. Before YouTube, you had to, order up books through your interlibrary loan service.
Sure.
The deal was that your library didn't have these tomes.
Right.
Usually, but they could find them for you, and then you could get them sent to your branch library, and then you could pour over them for the info you needed. But I noticed that, or you could send away to the IHR. Remember when in the old days you would send away to Willis Cardo?
Sure.
Institute for Historical Review.
And now things are all different there.
Everything's different, yeah. He doesn't care about history. Mark Weber might as well just scratch history from that, the name of that website now, because they don't discuss it.
And I think he got rid of all the books that were there, all of the titles that were there. They're all gone.
Well, he didn't want to pay for, warehousing them. And then, that was part of it. All those tapes that used to be able to order too from the IHR conferences when people came and gave talks about the stuff that they were experts in, I don't think you can get those anymore. You can't order up a videotape or an audio tape, because I used to get those.
Well, we're going to a quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today has been Charles Kraft. His website is charlescraft.com. Vladimir Lenin said, and I quote, "The best way to control the opposition is to lead it ourselves," unquote.
I think that's what's going on right now. Alt-right and alt-left.
Yes.
And what happened in Charlottesville and what happened before Charlottesville and probably what will happen after Charlottesville. I think that could be controlled opposition because the media has made such a mountain out of this business and turned everybody against each other, as I guess they wanted.
Sure.
I don't know how to. I don't have any evidence on anyone being controlled opposition. Really, I hear people accusing each other of shilling, but I don't know for sure. I really don't. But it seems plausible to me, and I'm sure it's going on.
Sure.
I'm sure those.
My guest next week is going to be talking about Charlottesville. But there's just so many things going on. So much hatred.
There really is. They're working us into a murderous frenzy here.
Right.
Hey, I wanted to get back to one thing.
Sure.
What we've been discussing for the last hour and a half or 2 hours has been intelligence. And this is primarily Gentiles, you know, that are running these intelligence operations. And the deal is, there's Jews involved, Jewish organizations that you don't hear about because unless you're Jewish, you don't know anything about them because they don't get written up. I mean, if you want to go into it, you can find out. But I discovered through a book that I picked up called Covert Network by Eric Thomas Chester, and it's called Progressives, the International Rescue Committee, and the CIA. And it's a history of the International Rescue Committee, which was set up in World War II to rescue Jews. And I think that the International Rescue Committee was... the reason why it was set up was because of Peter Bergson and his lobbying. I think he went to Roosevelt and the people around Roosevelt. And so that was one of the big Jewish organizations that was in place then. But there was also, listen to this, the International Relief, and these are Jewish, International Relief Association, International Rescue Committee, which we just mentioned, Emergency Committee, Emergency Rescue Committee, War Refugee Board, Jewish Labor Committee of the International Ladies Garment Union, American Committee for Christian Refugees and Jewish Refugees, and then the Jewish Colonization Association. The names of these organizations, as they popped up, I just made a list in the front of the book, but in order to understand how much... how much sway American Jewish organized Jewry had with
the government.
Yeah, the government. You can tell by the numbers of committees.
That book you're talking about, Kindle, it's $45.55. They don't want people to buy this book. It's $110. Well, thank you so much, Charles, for being on the program. It's just been delightful. So informative. Thank you so much.
Okay. Are we, no phone-ins?
No, nobody. I think people were so enthralled with your message that they didn't make phone calls.
Okay, and this is it? We're finished?
This is it. 3 hours.
Okay.
Seemed like...
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.